Oh, okay. So that's how it's going to go. You'll throw me under the bus when we go to court,
That's right.
when we're sued for having recorded without having the distinct permission of both parties. But I think we're going to talk about ethics and design, right?
Yeah. So let me give you a hypothetical. You are a software designer and/or developer of some sort, perhaps a project manager or someone who has some hand in building a product. And actually, I guess this doesn't even apply specifically to software alone, but let's use the context of software for this discussion. You've been hired for a job. You interviewed for the job. You're qualified for it. You got the job. You maybe even have been working there for a while, let's say 3 months, 6 months, on your small slice of the pie. You've got tasks that are specific to your team or your feature set or whatever you're building. But somewhere along the line, maybe through your own spelunking or through communication with higher ups on your team or peers, you've come to discover that what you're building is in some way, shape, or form built to intentionally exploit other people in some way. So that could take the form of manipulating people for to make them spend money on something they don't need to. It could be manipulating people to steal information from them, steal money from them, otherwise harm them physically, whatever it may be. But you've come to decide to understand that this is, or to believe at least that this is what may be what you're contributing to. What I'm curious about is what course of action you would take, how you would decide when it was appropriate to do that. And then kind of stepping back from there, I want to know where you think the line is drawn in ethics when it comes to design and exploiting things. Because at some level, everything that we're building and designing is built to exploit something. And usually it's a need or a social desire. But where's the line between a social desire and something that's immoral? So let's call that the scenario. It's complicated.
Wow. But so let me ask you, because I don't know if it's exploit. Everything that you design is used is any anything you design is presumably designed to fill a need. And that need and there's a business formula associated with that where like a user has a need, there's a business that wants to provide the service or the product to fill that need. There's a payback in some way to the business.
Right.
I don't know if it's necessarily exploiting. It's exploiting maybe when it goes beyond filling a need, or when there's probably a range of things. But let's go back to the less hypothetical part of this, because the definition of the generalized scenario you described sounds like it was generalized from something specific in your mind. So I'm curious to know, like, exactly more specifically, as a software designer or developer, what exactly was the specific case that got you thinking about this? Because let's start there.
So how did I get there?
Yeah.
It's a rabbit hole.
Bring it.
Rabbit hole. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, lately I have found myself drawn to and reading about the lesser understood parts of human cognition, specifically related to hypnotism. I don't know why, but it's something that's caught my attention and I find myself reading about, and I find it fascinating. And maybe I'm part skeptic, part scientist about it, and I want to know more. But that has led me to probably more of a thought experiment that definitely has some tangible benefits in the real world. So before you exiled yourself from Facebook, you've doubtlessly seen one of many videos on Facebook that is a square cropped video of someone, of an overhead shot of someone preparing something in the kitchen, right? Some kind of cooking instructional video. It is entirely possible that someone has figured out how to take advantage of something to do with hypnotism, hypnosis, etc., that some viewers of those types of videos that are viral and don't really have any, purpose apart from exploiting views, someone has figured out, let's say, how to take one of those and briefly, partially, whatever, hypnotize someone and cause them to, for purposes of argument, purchase something that they definitely don't need, in a way that they don't understand is happening. It's possible.
When you say it's possible, how possible?
I don't know.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. So it's not that you've been reading up in the Journal of Cognitive Science and Okay. So the idea of subliminal messaging has been around for a while.
Yes.
Allegedly, various department stores have used the use of an audio track that is sending suggestive messages to potential shoplifters not to commit the crimes. Mm-hmm. And, I think it's hard to find statistically significant results there because, you know, in order for it to be statistically significant, you need to be able to say that it was, that the effect of this treatment case had more impact, better, you know, the results than a sheerly random, like you're trying to say that it's more than just randomness. So sure. I don't know that, you know, there also, there was a well-known book that we'll probably have to put a link to about subliminal imagery and advertising. And the, you know, the cover, I think, had a photograph of a glass of scotch with ice in it. And then the book was soft cover, the one that I saw. And so the grainy black and white photographs on the inside wasn't, they weren't very compelling. Mm-hmm. But, you know, super zoomed in images. And it's like, oh, yeah, in the ice cube, there's a lady in a bikini. And so it's a presumably, yes, the over-shoulder cooking reality preparation, you know, the most amazing tortilla soup that you can make in an anchovy can and a toothpick, right?
I worry that I've gone too high into the sky already with the example. And I definitely have better tangible, real examples of this kind of thing happening that I can share. But I'm curious to hear where.
Okay, so I mean, I could imagine when I was an undergraduate, I had to participate in a bunch of experiments as part of my achieving my undergraduate degree. Mm-hmm. The department required that you become a guinea pig, and it turned out to be really useful. I mean, it serves the graduate students who couldn't convince enough people to be willing to put up with things, but it gives you an amazing insight into the experimental process. And so when you read about it in textbooks about how, students were, well, turns out now that wasn't really true, that whole Philip Zimbardo thing in the prison. I don't know if you read that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, made for a good story. So one of the things that I had to do was look at images, and there were images interspersed with words, and the words were like just Helvetica bold text on the screen. And then there'd be like a picture of like a, I don't know, like a flower. And then there'd be a picture of a, I don't know, a farm. And then there'd be a picture of like tanks rolling through like Tiananmen Square. And there'd be words that were flashing. And all I needed to do was look at them. So who knows how much of my current personality disorder is a result of being programmed through this seemingly innocent human experiment that I was part of.
Yep.
But and they measured hormone levels in my saliva as I looked at this combination of images and words.
Oh, that's cool.
And have you ever tried to produce 5 cubic centimeters of saliva on demand?
No, can't say that.
Like 10 times in a row?
No, certainly not.
Yeah. It wouldn't surprise me if they found high concentration of hormone and low amounts of saliva towards the end and attributed it to the pictures I was seeing and not to the fact that I was now parched like the Sahara.
Yeah.
But so I think that so as a mechanism to be able to change your affect or to suggest ideas to you that you might not have had is definitely like it's a known thing. Whether you can end up being made a fool of on a stage at a nightclub in the Bahamas by the R-rated hypnotist that same way through watching a cooking video, I don't know.
Sure. And maybe that's too heady.
It's requiring too much engagement, in order to pull it off. But so now you're a software developer and you're faced with the discovery that not only are you making a great codec for video compression, but you've actually enabled a company to feed in subliminal messaging as a result. And it's almost imperceptible to the human eye, but you run across like a library of code that is, you know, commented out stuff that says like, this is where we do the evil stuff. Mm-hmm. Remember to uncomment this line, you know,
yeah.
NPM install globally. Right. So, okay. And what do you do when you discover that?
Yeah. And if I had to give finite examples, in recent memory, of course, the thing that comes to mind the most is our friends over at Cambridge Analytica, right?
Mm-hmm.
Certainly someone was working there who didn't understand the full impact of what they were doing. Mm-hmm. Possibly as low as a college intern who was just trying to get course credit, but maybe even people who were there who had more scholarly goals, right? That they really thought it was an interesting research project, et cetera, et cetera. I also don't mean to imply that the people that were working there at some point realized they were doing bad and didn't report it, but it's possible that that happened. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious what your approach would be if you suddenly realized that the thing you were building was potentially doing harm to the world.
Did you say Snowden?
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a bit thorny, isn't it? So we worked for a company that had a combination of, feel good projects and others that might have made you think twice about it. I know of people who chose not to be on projects for companies that were associated with big tobacco.
Yeah. Yeah.
And similarly, that they didn't want to do public sector work because of the potential that they might be doing something for a military group.
Right.
I think that as a practitioner, you have your own ethical standard, and you either make a decision as to whether or not you can justify it, because it's never just yes or no or black and white. Right? So, what if you were assigned a project for RJ Reynolds, but you were working on a project for maybe one of their wellness programs that they're doing to try and prove that they're good corporate citizens, despite the damage that they've done elsewhere?
Yeah.
So can you justify this in your mind that you're not, I mean, you know, so you're cynical and jaded. So you're like, no, this is window dressing for a company that really just wants to find different ways to sell nicotine. And so you could say, no, I'm not going to be a part of it at all. Or you could say, maybe this is a possibility. You would never know the right answer. There's no single right answer. So you have to make that choice. I had participated on a couple projects that were related to the military. And it was at a time where there were things that were going on in the Afghanistan and Pakistan area. And I have a position that on this, I'm a pacifist, and I think that all of that is bad. But the work that I was being asked to help out with was going to help soldiers stay alive. So, yeah. I don't think I like the idea of supporting the military, but the idea of helping people stay alive makes really good sense, especially if it didn't mean that it would kill other people as a result.
Sure.
So, I think that it really depends. On the other hand, if you run into something like in your scenario, which is, so I think that this, the scenario that I faced and some of our colleagues faced with doing that, and I don't know if you saw, but there's a trending repository on GitHub, people signing to say that they would prefer that Microsoft drop ICE as a client,
mm-hmm.
As yeah, a customer.
Yeah.
And, so anyway, I'll reserve comment on that stand, but those scenarios where you end up having to do work for a client that you might have an ethical opposition to is probably much more common than mm-hmm. the scenario you described, just in the sense that being completely in the dark about this spurious functionality, If you had been kept in the dark, then there's no way that purposely kept in the dark, there's probably no way that you would ever get access to the information to know what it is that that you were actually doing. So you'd never have that crisis of faith.
Yeah.
It's highly unlikely. I can imagine a scenario where the data scientists and statisticians who were working at Cambridge Analytica could have been kept in the dark completely, getting access to data and data descriptions. And the only thing that they didn't know was about the consent of the data collection. And they could have just been told, yeah, this is all part of the contract that we have, and there's nothing, so you don't need to worry about that. You know, there's always a way to keep the academics engaged and give them limit the specifics so that they don't start to get all whistleblowery.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's what people do, is that they either drop a dime or they quietly disappear, depending on how powerful the company is, maybe they just get killed and put in a shallow grave in the desert.
Sure, sure.
Is that what you were imagining? That you'd discover this cooking show hijinks, and then next thing, it's like you disappeared, you're sleeping with the fishes?
I don't think so. I actually have fairly complicated feelings on a lot of this stuff. I think that as the person in the position to be the whistleblower, mm-hmm. I would like to think that that's an action I would take, right? At whatever cost to my job, well-being, et cetera. If the crisis was affecting a large enough swath of human population, I would become, I would put myself on the line. I think that's what I would like to think. I certainly can't tell you if that would be the reality. And I'm fully aware of that. I guess the other side of this is that I feel like I also think that the smartest groups of people in the world should be working on these problems that we know are going to be problems. So let me give an example of that. Recently, Google at their I/O annual summit, developer conference, whatever it is, did a demonstration of their Google Assistant voice service. Did you see this?
I did.
Yeah. So the general gist of it
is working at the pizza place.
Perfect. Yeah. The general gist of this is that Google demonstrated, they had an app demo that was on your phone. You say, okay, Google, and the phone, responds to you, and you say, book me an appointment for a massage this afternoon, or for a haircut this afternoon, or order me a pizza for dinner tonight. And what the assistant is able to do is to find a local business that fits your need. So if it's you're ordering a pizza, it finds a pizza place. It will call them. Your assistant, your digital, this program will call the pizza company, and essentially without announcing that it's a machine doing the talking, it will get through the conversation and order you a pizza for dinner at 5 o'clock. They've gone as far as to add like head fakes that make you think it's a human that you're talking to, and it's fairly indistinguishable unless you're really, really paying attention. And I would wager that most people working at a pizza parlor kind of aren't listening for robots calling them, but things like ums and ahs are added into the conversation. So you might say, hey, I need a pizza delivered for 5 o'clock tonight at 1200 Main Street. And the person on the phone would say something like, okay, what do you want on it? And the Google Assistant responds with, I think just pepperoni, right? In a way that sounds very human. So this was the demo that Google gave. And apart from it being like some really kind of flashy technology, I think there was maybe a 24-hour wave of people going from this is really cool to like, holy cow, that's terrifying, right? Suddenly we don't know if we're talking to a computer or a human on the phone, and that's really scary. And I understand that, and I get that. And I think that there is a ethical obligation on Google's side to put some very obvious tell in when you're talking to a machine, right? That if a computer assistant is going to call me, it should say, hey, this is Mike's Google assistant calling on behalf of Mike to order a pizza, whatever it may be. And the sacrifice and lost time there is fine. But I think that's the conclusion that everyone drew, or most everyone drew, in response to this. But there were also calls for Google to essentially stop working on sort of thing, and that it should never be released. And I sort of very firmly believe that if the biggest companies in the world are working on these problems, they're going to be the ones who are able to understand when we're being faked out. And I think that that's a very necessary thing that's coming. I think in next decade, there's going to be videos, audio, any type of media can be completely faked without your agency. that can make show you or anyone doing anything you want, having conversations. There are deep faked videos where you can see people, you know, they put Barack Obama in a porn, right? Like all kinds of crazy stuff. And I think that having really smart people working on those problems will help us to detect those problems, and that there's no sense in stopping Google, Facebook, Apple, whatever, from working on these problems, because that's an outcome that we need. We know it's coming. If they don't do it, someone else will. That's how I feel about it. And I think that's where some of the conflict comes on this stuff.
That's interesting. So your fears are of robots. They visit you in your dreams.
Yeah, exactly.
They extract your pizza order from your head without you knowing it.
Mm-hmm.
Those are my dreams too.
Sure.
So that's really interesting. I think that so if Google doesn't do it, then the bad guys will do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. But if Google does it, the bad guys will also do it.
Yes. I agree
so
with you.
So it's not either or, it's and, right?
Yep.
Okay.
And maybe Google are the bad guys too. I'm willing to accept that. But I also think that if it's coming, the technology is coming, we owe it to ourselves to have the best possible understanding of the ins and outs and the flaws of the technology. And it's always going to be a race to the bottom in terms of who can do it better and best and fake each other out more, but it's coming. It's here.
Yeah. Yeah. And the it seems similar to the conflict or the response to when people post exploits, software and hardware exploits, and they describe the exploit, and the one possible response to that is like, why would you tell the bad guys how to do it?
Yeah.
But it's the same mechanism, of course, that tells the good guys how to fix it.
Yeah.
So, because information.
Right.
Yeah.
What do you think about it? Let's use that voice example as a specific.
If you know the name of the movie you'd like to see, press one. Yeah. You know, the one of the problems that makes it difficult to have a very clear sense of this is that I'm fascinated by the technology. And so the idea of stopping development is like the equivalent to like burn the books, you know. This is important revelations and discoveries and creation. And it's my feeling is that it helps us understand more about what the essence of humanity is.
Yeah.
So apart from the how cool it is and the AI and the you know, if you were to get, you know, like tell me the address and you tell the address and the Google assistant says, oh yeah, across from the gas station. Nice. You know, and it's all about being more human. And it makes us think about like, is that what it takes? Hey, what would it take for an alien to come to the Earth and fit in completely? You know, what are the...
Right.
The wacky little right. human things that it needs to pick up so that it's like, oh, when humans nod and grin, it means, and no matter how many times it tries to figure out the rule and the response, there's always something.
Yeah.
If I could do a video cut right now, it would be to that scene with the heavy metal dudes in Family Guy.
The Eastern European guys, yeah. Let's go to the discotheque and have a good time. Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking of.
but it is uncanny.
Yeah.
The realism of it. And as a pragmatist, if they can make it actually respond better than the... So you say you want support. Do you want support with your... or your you know, and it's like, no, I need, get me the operator. Like if it can make the process more efficient, because they're going to have to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Or they'll hire people who can't speak.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I don't know.
You know, that's an interesting thing to mention too, that it's easy to forget that technologies like this enable people with disabilities.
Of course. Right?
There are people who are unable to speak or have difficulty communicating with other people over the phone, that this may change their lives fundamentally.
A guaranteed will. Think about Stephen Hawking.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So that was a very that was a speak and spell. You know, it was using that TI yeah. chip or whatever. Right. But it how far back in time, no pun intended, would our understanding of the that's pretty good, huh? It's an enabling technology, and it could be used for evil. And it's really not that different then from being part of being in a situation where you're doing work that you know has a potential, you know, negative outcome.
Yeah.
And this definitely gets into that terrible slippery slope where it's like, no, if you make guns,
right.
you're making a thing that's used to kill people. No, no, no. It's I use guns to show how virile I am. So it's not about killing people. It's about overcoming my own insecurities as a right. functioning citizen. And then pointing at a page in the Bible, you know,
like, no, I do no. feel like we're headed very quickly into a like very deep philosophical discussion on ethics along the lines of Kant and, you know, whoever else were, the deep thinkers of their day. I find it hard to distill into one thought, but I think that at its most basic level, I believe that all of the hard problems are problems that are worth working on, whether they are on their face creative or destructive, might be a way to put it.
Hmm.
Because I think there are valuable things to be distilled from all of those. Though there are definitely short-term risks, big short-term risks for some things. But there might be a world, for example, where the nuclear bomb technology that we have from the Manhattan Project and on is beneficial when we're Armageddon-nining it out into space to launch at a space rock that's hurtling towards Earth. And so these things are, I think they're problems that are worth working on, and I don't think they're worth working on if you know they're being used for bad. That's a different story. So in other words, if you suddenly realize you're working at Cambridge Analytica and you're trying to turn the election, like, yeah, maybe you should quit and raise all the red flags. But if, it's a scholarly pursuit and you're trying to better understand the universe, I think I'm all for it.
Yeah. I think they said the people who worked on the Manhattan Project weren't, the scientists anyway, were not, bloodthirsty killers.
Mm-hmm.
Their research was being sponsored by bloodthirsty killers. I think that last part of your statement is the one that I'm not so sure that I agree with, which is that if you know that the thing that you're making is used for bad things, that you should stop doing it. I mean, that's a personal decision that you can make.
Yeah.
I think...
tell me more about that.
Well, if I make something, let's say I make a really neat camera that streams to the internet, I know that some people are using it for bad things.
Hmm.
Am I going to stop making the camera?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe knowing that it could be used for ill.
Right.
I mean, like if I made batteries, like those coin cell batteries, amazing, right?
Yeah.
But if you swallow it, you'll die.
Right.
So presumably you could feed it to someone and they would die. Your thing. So, I think historically we've seen so many people who have invented things with an intention. It's completely different intention than the outcome. Like the person who invented Zyklon B, the gas that killed millions of people.
Mm-hmm.
And he was Jewish, and he never anticipated
sure.
that it would be used the way that it was.
Sure,
and the irony of the way that it was used made it even more painful, right? But I don't know that there's a clear answer. I think as someone who's designing a product, if your intention is bad. Then I don't really know what to say.
Yeah.
You know, but I also think that a bad outcome and a good outcome, it's not all that clear.
Yeah. Okay.
So going back to the making things for the military, my dad owned a company that made fiberglass things. And so in addition, they're making stuff for like surfboards and dune buggies and things like that. He also made things that the military used to insulate some of their troop carrying trucks. And he had a very strong opposition to the government and a very strong opposition to what the military was doing and a very strong opposition to the way that the military was behaving. And those trucks would have been showing up right in the place doing the things that were so abhorrent. And the justification or the rationalization or the determination to actually produce these things was that he'd been in the military himself.
Oh, wow.
And didn't necessarily want to be there.
Yeah.
But also recognized that most of the people who were there didn't want to be there either.
Right, right.
But they had to be there. Hmm. And so, you know, maybe it was thinking about how hard it gets in those trucks while you're waiting to do what you're ordered to do because you're a soldier.
Right.
That he was like, okay, so then am I going to turn this down? Let someone make garbage that won't work. So it's
everything is a gray area. It's very hard to give a single answer, certainly.
Well, as a UX designer, how do you feel about implementing or creating a dark pattern?
Yeah, right.
Okay, so when you try to turn off the advertising tracking and all of that on your phone, how many bizarre violations of all that is holy in user interaction design patterns and best practices do you have to force your way through before you get access to a switch that only does part of what you would like it to do?
Your
job as a UX designer is you need to design this to achieve the business goal. Mm-hmm. And the business goal is letting less people opt out of tracking.
Right. Yeah, much like the designer for any news site you've been on your phone in the past 5 years, where every third sentence is interrupted by a screen long, picture or video ad.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as we'd like to believe that the customer of every designer is the user, that's really not the case.
No, it's not the case.
Yeah.
It's not the case, especially when it's free.
Right. And you and I definitely both know from experience that can be an extremely difficult thing to explain to both sides of that table.
When one of the jobs that I had, I worked at ZDNet, and I worked in a group that did ad innovation. So, building the better ad banner.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a designer and a developer type wannabe, it was entertaining to try and figure out the fun, cool, engaging things.
Yeah.
At a certain point, it stopped being about how much I hate advertising and more about like, no, I've been hired to like come up. And so maybe because I hate advertising so much, I'm going to try and find engaging ways to do this. How can we let a company get their pixels in front of a user's face, but still give the users just enough control where they don't feel like they're being strong-armed into having to consume those pixels.
Mm. Boy, it would be fascinating to read a history of advertising on the web.
Well, yeah, it would be. I hope that nobody saved all those punch the monkey banners and whatever. But I certainly, some of the things that we innovated were things that have made it into, were part of the common ad lexicon. 1,200 pixels of image that goes down the right-hand side of the page that should have been content that you wanted. Instead, it was content that was bought. But jamming video into a banner and games into a banner, and all while trying to do it to meet the editorial guidelines of the initial download has to be less than 2K and, without user clicking, something to ask for more garbage to show up. There's only a certain amount of garbage we can show. The first set of banners that I ever designed, the creative director said, oh, these are very nice, but nobody's going to click them. He's like, you're not doing beautiful design here. You're doing things that are going to interrupt people's brain patterns.
Yeah. So do you think that qualifies as an exploit?
So what I was trying to do is exploit without being so ham-fisted.
Yeah, okay.
You know? So I wanted to, you know, I think one of the ad banners that I did was for one of the like electronics stores that sells stereos and stuff. And so I thought it would be really funny to do something with loudspeakers that were booming, not actual sound, but that it looked like they were booming. And it said, annoy your neighbors. So yeah, the creative director was like, that's awesome, but it looks pretty. Can you make make it like it would give someone a seizure? Make those things move more, flickering, make it look like it's broken. I was like, but that's horrifying. He said, yeah, but if you want, we can run your little precious ad against a garish fluorescent green thing that looks like it's glitching. Mm-hmm. And I guarantee you, I'll pay you money. So you're saying you'd be the whistleblower?
I would like to think so.
Yeah.
It depends on context. You're totally sure. Right, and it's good to point that out.
And what the costs would be to you to be able to be the whistleblower and what channels you really have.
Yeah.
You may be under an NDA.
Yeah.
And the then the only thing that you can do is leave.
Right.
And or so call, that's a cost.
You'd call Michael Avenatti. He's really good at ignoring NDAs.
Maybe we could get him as a guest.
He likes to talk.
I think he likes to tweet too. So he could do us some serious social media advertising.
That's the truth.
And I know how to make a garish banner.
Oh man, this is really interesting.
I think we should definitely pick it up, but again. And then I'm thinking it becomes a movie. And Matt Damon is the designer developer who blows a whistle.
Yeah, I'm into that.
Mm-hmm. Or Steven Seagal.
Maybe both.
He can tell injustice. He sees it. He sees it and he acts. Matt Damon, I don't know, what would he do? He went, you know, like he was like the, you know, I'll go on tape. I'll wear a wire. Steven Seagal is like, I'll kick him and I'll break his arm by bending it backwards.
Yeah. And Steve Buscemi can be the villain and everything. It'll be great.
Or Gary Busey.
Ooh, even
actually,
better.
Why or? And Steve Buscemi and Gary Busey.
Hmm.
Steve Buscemi as Gary Busey's ventriloquist dummy.
Love it. We're going to be rich.
Oh, the money. I can hear it. I can hear it now.
I'm going to get rid of this podcasting gambit.
Oh, I know. And start working on the kicking.